Welcome to a Sober Girls Guide podcast, a lifestyle podcast based on sobriety and recovery. I'm your host and sober girl, Jessica Jabot. Inspired by my own sobriety and wellness journey, I want to spread the wealth of knowledge. Tune in each week for uncensored conversations about mental health, self-development, wellness and spirituality, and how they influence each guest's unique recovery journey. My goal is to educate and inspire and to let you know you are not alone on your recovery journey. Thanks so much for tuning in to a Sober Girls Guide podcast. Let's go! Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 257 of a Sober Girls Guide podcast. Now, we usually don't have sober guys on the podcast. We like to keep the focus on the ladies. But this week, we made an exception because one of Austin's most prized possessions, Philip Spear, is here. Philip is a world-renowned pastry chef and a pillar of strength in the health and wellness community here in Austin. He is here to talk about how he is shaking up the restaurant biz, both in and out of the kitchen. From non-alcoholic options on the menus to starting the first run club for those based in the food and beverage scene. On this episode, you will learn why non-alcoholic options are beneficial to both the customer and the restaurant owners, how the science of addiction can help change your relationship with alcohol, and how community is vital when making long-lasting changes stick. This is such a fantastic episode. Let's get into it. Philip, I am so excited to talk to you. You are the man about Austin. Everyone is singing your praises, like from the Lululemon folks to health and wellness communities. They are like, you gotta talk to Philip. He is the man in Austin. So welcome, Philip. I'm so excited to have a conversation with you. How are you doing?
I'm doing well today. Thank you so much. And I'm grateful to not only join you, but to hear that people have sung my praises in Austin. Austin's my home, so I feel good about that. I've been here for nearly 30 years, which is most of my life.
Wow. Where are you originally from?
I'm from Texas. I'm from South Texas. I'm from McAllen. I lived in pretty much every city in the valley, the RGV. I was born to two young teenage parents in South Texas, and we moved around a whole lot, but I've spent, 42 of my 46 years in Texas.
You definitely put down roots in Austin, and people are just loving everything you're doing, from your restaurant Commodore to the Commodore Run Club, and just how you are just so open and vulnerable about your own recovery. So I would love to hear what your BS self looked like. Your before sobriety self. If you could give us a behind the scenes version of that.
For sure. I'll start about midway in my adolescence. I grew up with my father. He was 17 when I was born. My parents split. I spent the majority of the time with my dad, although I did see my mom on occasions for those, the first 10 years or so that they were split up. She moved to Chicago. I spent some time there. As an adolescent, I never went to one school for more than 1 year, so I didn't really have a traditional root system with a community of people in my school. So school wasn't much for me. I actually ended up leaving the traditional school system my sophomore year. I didn't even really start my sophomore year, and I moved to Austin when I was 16 alone. I moved with some friends, and we were roommates. But I left the support of my family and branched out on my own. So I got to Austin in the summer when I was 16 years old. I soon turned 17 and have been here ever since. I was a young skateboarder and thought I knew everything, and had this thought that if I was just kind of screwing around in Houston, which is where I was, not doing much, I might as well go to Austin and take a go at it. I had a plan to come here and get my GED and go to community college. I come from a long line of educators, and intellectuals. My father's a PhD, he's the dean of the political science department at the Houston Community College. His parents both have multiple degrees and were teachers or professors. My grandfather was a Methodist preacher. And then on my mom's side, a group of Mexican women, she and her sisters and then her mother and their sisters, all highly educated. And even through a lot of adversity, were able to get college degrees, master's degrees, or even PhDs. So I came from a long line
Wow.
of educators and really traditional schooling, forward-thinking people. However, it just didn't work for me. Ended up in Austin. Succeeded in getting my GED and starting community college. But it didn't feel much different. It never resonated with me. And I began working in kitchens. Somewhat out of necessity, because that was a job that you could acquire without much education, or at least traditional mm-hmm. education. But there was quickly found out there was some passion there. So when I was 17, I started working in bakeries and spent the next 20 years working through bakeries and restaurants in Austin, and mm-hmm. Worked my way up to a pretty successful career as a pastry chef. I received a lot of national recognition and some critical accolades for it.
Some very critical accolades. You're being very humble.
I had some good success with that. In the meantime, I was also in the traditional cultural kind of bad boy chef, skateboarder chef, hip hop, punk rock, like reading Kitchen Confidential as my Bible, saying that, you know, if I'm going to be here and be a chef and travel the country cooking and doing these events, and I'm going to drink heavily and party heavily, and I'm going to live that part of the lifestyle too. Spent that 20 years doing so. In that time, though, I had a daughter, who's now 20, almost 25, she'll be 25 next month. At 21, I had a little girl. I had another little girl 10 years later. And so as I was in my addiction, in my career, very high, what I believed to be high stakes, high pressure career, fueled by lots of drinking, a little bit of drug use at first, and then having a very full home life, left little time to figure out anything for myself or about myself. So I was doing all of that with some unaddressed trauma, and which then led to really, really poor health decisions as well. I mean, obviously putting poison in my body every day was a poor health decision. But I did not take care of myself at all. So, you know, by the end of that 20 year period, and I keep saying 20 year period because I quit drinking at 37. I ballooned up to like 285 pounds. I was smoking a pack and a half of cigarettes a day. I was eating nothing but the worst food you could possibly put in your body out of convenience and working, 70, 80, 90 hours a week, depending on what was going on at that time. And I had severe sleep apnea. I found out I had type 2 diabetes. And never exercised, never did anything to take care of myself. Never went to therapy, nothing.
Wow. So
when that day finally came, when I quit drinking, there was a lot to go through. And there's still a lot to go through.
Yeah.
For sure. But, over that 20-year period of everything I explained, there was also a lot of getting in trouble with the law. I had multiple DWIs, multiple PIs, bar fights, like just the typical, as you said, BS mm-hmm. that goes along with it, especially as a male run mainly by ego and need for external validation. I was in everyone's face and kind of, look at me, and just trying to become, in my thought, I was I was chasing success, but I didn't have a real definition of what that success was. So,
wow. So what made you change your relationship with alcohol?
Well, funny. And I mean, even on my, maybe not funny, interestingly, though, on my fourth DWI, which was another rollover accident. This time it was I flipped a car into a live gas main, which then shut down part of the city. I was woken up with the news camera. There was literally woken up with a news camera, and that was on the news immediately. It was on, it made national news because in my career I had achieved some pretty high profile status. It was a decently large news story. And I knew I needed to go to rehab listen to this. I knew I needed to go to rehab to beat my court case that I was coming up on. I had still didn't really think I had an alcoholic, even after four rollover DWIs. And luckily I've never hurt anyone else or myself. After, you know, just living a life of complete mayhem at that point, I still was like, okay, these are the steps I need to take to not go to jail for 10 years. Cause in Texas, it's a 10-year minimum sentence. So I went, once I was released from jail, it's 10 days mandatory. Once I was released from jail and I knew I was going to face a 10-year sentence, I did immediately what my lawyer said I needed to do to build a case against this. So I was in rehab, La Hacienda here in Texas, in Central Texas, still not believing I was an alcoholic, still thinking that one day I would probably drink again, but it was time to take a break. And it wasn't until about 2 weeks into rehab, two of my 4 weeks that I was there, that I had said out loud that I was an alcoholic. And so a few things happened within that couple of weeks for me to understand that I was. So it was me taking a break from drinking. It was changing my relationship with drinking. But for the first couple of weeks, however, it wasn't until about halfway through where it was completely severing my relationship with alcohol. And that's what it looked like at first. It looked like a lot of anger towards alcohol and a lot of anger towards the restaurant business and everyone around me and everything that allowed me to get to that point. Cause that's how I was still looking at it, still looking at it as all of these things, my environment made me into an alcoholic, or my, you know, the acceptance of this behavior in our field made me an alcoholic, or alcohol made me an alcoholic. And so like I had anger at all of that. You know, that we can talk about that a little bit more, but the changes in my relationship with alcohol had to do with needing to stop because it was the right thing to do legally, and then learning that I was an alcoholic, and then finding this anger towards that, and then shutting it out of my life. So that's how I changed. Okay. How I changed my relationship with alcohol.
Okay, so you basically changed out of a need to stay out of jail.
Yeah.
To get your get out of jail free card, right? And then
I was able to stay out of jail. And that was huge because it was a possible 10-year sentence. And I mean, and like I just need to like acknowledge my privilege in that, and I get that. And I'm thankful for and grateful for every day that I'm here. And so it's really important to me to use this time to be someone who's visible in this space, whose story can either help someone, or I can personally help someone one-on-one, or whose story can help us across whatever, my community, other communities, the country, who knows?
Yeah, definitely. So when you were in rehab, when did it kind of like hit you? Like, oh, actually, I should probably stay away from alcohol for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
Like that, or did it ever click in rehab, or when you got out?
No, it did. I mean, it did, but I needed to have the doctor's opinion. I needed to understand that it wasn't I wasn't weak. Right? This is still I'm still an eagle. But I had to get it in a way. I had to be explained to me scientifically, where I was like, oh, this isn't about me having a fucked up life or me being weak or me not being able to control what I drink. There's an actual physical scientific issue of how my dopamine receptors receive alcohol, how the allergen works in my body. Like, I had to understand all of that. And my rehab was great in explaining that side of it. Mm-hmm. And that's what allowed me to be like, okay, cool, I can be an alcoholic, because it's something I was born with.
Okay.
And my views around that today are very different, but that was what it took for me to be like, oh, okay, cool, I can't drink, it doesn't work for me. And so that helped me understand that if it's a scientific thing, if it doesn't work with my body, if there's some sort of chemical imbalance when alcohol hits my bloodstream, then I can never drink again. And then it was like easier for me to accept that it was about that and nothing else.
Yeah, because it's not personal.
Right. It's not personal. I mean, it's not having anything in my life that I need to deal with that I can control. The surprise ending is that it's all of those things. But but at that time, that's what I needed to hear, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So that got you through rehab. It kept you sober for how long?
Well, today I've been sober 9.5 years. Once out of rehab, I was committed to not drink anymore because I had learned that I couldn't scientifically. Right. I also was, that first year was I still had a lot of anger, guilt, and shame, which still arises. But I had anger, guilt, and shame on not only, again, like the culture, the business, alcohol itself, society, our society's acceptance and expectations of alcohol and alcohol engagement. Again, acceptance of how we engage with alcohol in our world. I was mad at all of that, and so for that first year, like, I didn't go back to restaurants. I didn't want to go back to the restaurants. I didn't want to be around alcohol. I had so much anger that allowed me to really push that first year, and then into the years like 2 and 3. Is when I really started to understand more about, it didn't really have anything to do with alcohol. It had everything to do with me and what was going on inside of me, and some things that happened in my life previously that kept me in a space of addiction. And I learned that because, as I was looking at other, I had sort of transferred that addiction to other things, right? And you hear this a lot, okay. Transferred it to running. I had transferred it to being very. I wanted to lose. I wanted to change my whole physical appearance because I was so mad, and I was still mad at myself. And I lost 100 pounds in a year, right? So I was addicted to doing everything I need to do to lose weight and to change how I physically showed up in the world. And so through running and being super super. Managing like everything that I put into my body, and kind of being addicted to that, able to get healthy and lose weight and like be this new person that I was sure everyone would understand that was a new, better person. Because if I was going to be taken down in the public eye, which is what I thought had happened because I was woken up with that news camera and there were tons of articles about how I wasn't a great person, how I wasn't, there's a lot. There's a lot of comments. And like I allowed myself to kind of dig into that and read the comments and the articles and the social media and all of that.
First rule. First rule of Sober Club. Never read the comments.
Never. I had to show the world that I was that not only was I going to show up in the world differently, but I was going to show up physically as a different person. And so I did. So like working through that and those next couple of years, I was in AA. I would go to AA meetings. I didn't really do AA. Okay. But I would show up. I would show up and I would meet people, and I would have community around that, which was very helpful. There was, you know, I definitely took advantage of the fellowship aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it wasn't until year two and three that I really had any sort of working the program. And, you know, I know that's not for everyone, and you know, there's all sorts of reasons not to drink today. But for me, where I was working that program and those 12 steps helped me unravel a little bit more what was going on inside. I'm not active in the program today, but I have built and joined and built and sustained lots of communities through that fellowship, and show up in service many, many other ways, because I truly believe that is one of the most important parts of that work that you learn.
Oh, definitely. Community is everything. Mm-hmm. And relationships and building relationships is so important in our lives. It's so fulfilling.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure.
So it sounds like you were really doing all this kind of like damage control after this like big, you know, situation hit. The news was all over you. They were just really bringing you down, trying to tell you who you were and what you weren't. Yeah. And you were going on this kind of journey of like proving everyone wrong. And in the meantime, you got sober, you were changing your outside appearance. What, tell me about the changing the inside stuff.
Yeah.
When did that start happening, and what did that look like for you?
Well, it started happening through some of the step work and, you know, learning, digging a little bit deeper into myself. And there are some people in my life that I connected to that were able to guide me through some of that in a way that helps me understand it more. That it changed when I started seeing a therapist and really kind of digging into some of the things that had happened in my life leading up to the point of being deep in the addiction, as well as things that were going on through all through that timeline, things that I'm still looking at today. And well, I'm sure we'll look at for the rest of my life. So
yeah, it's the fun of life, right? We're never done.
So yeah. They're just unraveling through self-reflection and like structure around that self-reflection through some step work, through some therapy, through a lot of reading, a lot of podcasts. It's a lot of time committed to saying, hey, what is actually going on inside? What is going on with me and emotionally and mentally? And are there things that we understood as a kid mentally that affected me throughout my adolescence and adulthood that was maybe ignored or not paid attention to? Were there things as a kid emotionally that affected me through the way I was raised, through, you know, how my parents were towards me, how, you know, what kind of roots I had in the different communities I lived in, where I grew up, like, were there things around that I internalized as, or took on as my own burden and never let go of and worked through? Were there relationships that had issues or dissolved or should have or shouldn't have existed that I then internalized and took on that burden and never really worked through or unraveled? And, you know, that builds up and you just get sort of calloused to everything. That's when like the numbing agents come in and work really, really well. So,
right.
Again, it's a work in progress, but it's like kind of working backwards through all of that. There's some jumping around as well. It's not a completely working backwards, but it's just that it's like putting structure to the unraveling of who I am through self-reflection was it writing? It's all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
definitely. So tell me how you got back into the kitchen. It sounds like you're really trying to stay away from it, or
was
some resentments there.
I was. And I started doing some consulting. Through that consulting, I met some people who are still friends today who needed some help with their business, and ended up taking on a full-time role with them in their restaurant. while I was doing that. My previous employer, or someone part of who was part of that group, approached me. They had a friend opening a restaurant in Austin and thought that I'd be a perfect fit for that, especially after I had displayed a few years of some recovery. And I went and opened a restaurant of my own, or with some a partnership called Bon Ami. That restaurant only lasted about a year. There's a lot of issues there, still a lot of things to work on. But we did it. It had a lot of critical success. It just didn't have much financial success. And, you know, I wasn't ready to lead a whole team yet. So it was a good lesson in that. Other mistakes were made, but essentially, you know, just it didn't work out for the long term, but it was a great experience. From there, immediately I had another opportunity to open a new restaurant with another group. And I learned a lot from that experience, and with the partners that I currently have, was able to do this restaurant, which is Comedor, which is currently operating. We're going on 5 years next month, which is a pretty great milestone for a restaurant, and especially in this market. You know, we were open 11 months before COVID hit. So, you know, staying alive through the pandemic, through all of the changes that have happened in business, for this solid 5 years has been awesome. But
that's huge.
I learned that restaurant is where I want to be and what I want to do. And I wanted to create a space in the restaurant business, in the hospitality business, that was aware and cognizant, and even to some degree, like, really open about people's struggles in the business. So here at our restaurant, we're the headquarters for Binge Friends, which is a nonprofit group for sober food and beverage professionals, or sober curious food and beverage professionals as well. That's a nonprofit based in Charleston that is in 24 cities, I think, at this point around the country, hosting multiple meetings a week, in person or on Zoom. And I'm also on the executive board for that nonprofit. Then we created the Comedor Run Club, which is a space for food and beverage professionals and others to connect in daytime hours over healthy habits. So it's a new space, a different space, a coexisting space with what other people choose to do to build community in the restaurant business. But it's a space that we connect over healthy habit. It's great to be able to do that. We have a tagline to shift the post-shift culture, which is, you know, this post-shift or after work drink that we're so used to having. And that is kind of what gets you going. And often it happens at the restaurant. So that's actually something we don't do in our restaurant either. We don't do shift drinks. We use that resource to provide other things, like a once a week yoga in our building. So that's open to anyone in the hospitality business. We just create some incentives and programming around healthy decisions in the restaurant business. And, you know, we've decided that it's important to us to insure everyone and to pay people a living wage. So we do all those things in our restaurant, which makes it a little easier to be in the restaurant business. It's made it easier for me. So,
yeah, definitely. Why do you think the restaurant industry is so just tightly linked with abusing alcohol and promoting, like, unhealthy behaviors?
I mean, there's a lot of reasons. I think the easiest reason to relate to, or maybe the lowest hanging fruit, is the hours.
Sure.
Right. Like, we don't get off work until 8, 9, 10, 11 p.m., midnight. After midnight, as a bartender, you don't get off work till the middle of the night. There's not a lot to do, or at least that's what we thought. There wasn't anything to do except go to a bar after work.
Right.
You know, there's articles and stories about how, oh, it's expendable cash in your pocket. It's the only opportunity to connect is at a bar. It's the high-paced environment of the restaurant, of the floor, of the kitchen, which leads to high stress and a really like hyper and a super intense central nervous system that when you come off work, you need to wind down. You need to calm your central nervous system down and slow down, which I do believe. Yeah. I just think there's other ways to do it.
There's definitely other ways to do it.
Those other ways are, it's a culture that was celebrated for a lot of years. And I think it's all of those things, plus the stress, plus, you know, I don't know. I sometimes say, like, does the hospitality business or does the industry make the addict, or does the addict make the industry? You know, this is a job that you can work when, and especially 20 years ago, or 25 mm-hmm. years ago, 30 years ago, with a felony on your record, without a college degree, without a high school degree. It was often looked at as a transient job in a restaurant, because you can go from city to city and pick up a job really easily just by walking in the back door of a restaurant.
Right.
So a lot of these things all come together to kind of create this perfect storm. And again, which I've said multiple times at this point, for many, many years, it was celebrated. It was kind of a badge of honor. And it was a mainly, especially in the kitchen, a mainly like male dominated field. And there's a lot of ego and a lot of showboating and a lot of stress and pressure. And so the wind down moments, the blowing off steam, that was very much ingrained in the culture, as it is ingrained, I think, in the culture of just our nation, even internationally, of like, when the men go work hard and then they go blow off steam and that's okay. But we did it at 11 PM, 12 AM, you know, 1 AM, 2 AM in the morning. And you know, there's trouble to get into around that time.
Oh yeah. So, I know. I used to DJ in LA, so I know all about that trouble because I most likely created it.
Exactly. And it was okay. And I mean, I'm older now, right? It's so funny to talk like this, but I remember when like you would go in for a morning shift. If you had to work a morning shift, you know, there's this like misnomer, like these old tropes of like, oh, chefs hate to work brunch because chefs don't want to get up early because they're drunk, right? And like I remember going into brunch shifts and like chefs having like shots set out for their cooks. I'm like, okay, take a pair of the dog, a little bitters and a shot to get you going, and then you would work your brunch shift and maybe be fine by the end of it, and then you're immediately drinking again Sunday Funday. And you know, it was just the way you did it, right? The reward for a good job done was a beer. You know, until just recently, menus all over the country say buy the kitchen or buy the staff a beer. A lot of my language is from, because I've been a chef my whole career, but this is true for every part of the restaurant and hospitality business, behind the bar, on the floor, whatever it is, you have those high pressure, high stress situations. But a lot of what I say is like from the kitchen's viewpoint. Buy the kitchen a beer, and then like your ticket printer comes up, it's like, you get a beer. Right. And then by the end of the night, you have like multiple beers while you're cleaning up. And then of course, you're going to want to go out, like you're with your friend. You've been in this like high pressure, high stress moment. And then all of that dissipates. And then you're having some beers and you're cleaning up. And then instantly you're like close. Right. You're like, let's go out. Let's do this. Yep. And it was the handbook. And that was socially accepted. It's a whole combination of things that just kind of just keep brewing to keep it that way. But over the last, you know, 5 years or so, like I've seen a real, real change in how we're looking at it. And I think people are waking up, and, you know, it's not only the newer generations, but even my generation is waking up to like how bad it was and how bad, like, if I would if you're a chef my age in their like later 40, mid to later 40s, you're likely sober. You've likely come out on.
Well, this is your sign. This is your sign to probably reevaluate your relationship with alcohol.
You've probably come out on the other side and continue to stay in the business. Either that, yeah. Or you've burnt out, you've quit, or you're not doing it anymore. A lot don't make it. There's a period of time where like suicides and deaths were happening left and right, and it was due to depression, which was sustained by the alcoholism, drug use, and really, you know, the culture of just the restaurant. So,
yeah. Do you think you would be in the position you are in now if you kept drinking?
No, I'm sure I would be dead or in jail. No, I mean, zero doubt in my mind. I mean, and that's only from like watching, looking back, because this is 10 years later, almost 10 years later from that point. And every few years, I have these points in my life through drinking where my rock bottom, you know, rock bottom is that moving target, right? So like where my rock bottom became lower, lower, and lower. And there's zero doubt in my mind that if I had continued down this path, the worst case scenario is I would have hurt someone, which every day I think about that, like no joke, like how no one was ever hurt. Myself would be the second worst thing that could happen. Right. So, and then, or continued, you know, if I didn't kill myself through a car wreck or like spiraling depression or an overdose on something, because believe me, when I had some drinks, I would do whatever, just about whatever I could get my hands on. I would definitely have done something to put me, you know, a 50 WI probably would not have gone off of just rehab, right?
No.
And it wasn't just rehab. I mean, there was a lot more to it. It was a lot of work, but still, you know, it would be any of those things. If I had continued drinking, I am sure that my life would be very different.
Yeah, definitely.
Or a heart attack. I mean, I was, you know, 100 pounds overweight, and like that wasn't changing. Yeah. I wasn't doing anything for myself. So who knows?
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, but at that age, that stuff happens when you're unhealthy in your later 40s, getting into your 50s, like that's when you die.
Yeah.
From not taking care of yourself.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah. Wow. I mean, good for you. I can't believe you lost all that weight. That's a huge accomplishment as well.
Yeah, just changing my, you know, it's the consumption, right? It's like we just, you know, just consuming everything for me that was terrible, and like now I can, you know, I can control what I consume, so now I consume things that make me feel better rather than things that kill me.
Yeah, alcohol, you know, included.
Physically, mentally, you know, I mean, there's so much bullshit we can consume if we let ourselves do it, which then puts us in a physical downward path or a mental or emotional downward path. Like, you got it. Be really careful with what you put in your body. Your body listens and keeps the score, right?
Oh, yes, it does.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I want to talk about Commodore a little bit, because you do have a really fantastic non-alcoholic drink menu.
I do.
And I wanted to ask you, from not only from someone who is sober perspective, but from a business owner, you know, what are the benefits of having such a great menu like this? Because there might be someone else who has a restaurant too, and they're thinking about, oh, should I bother, you know, with non-alcoholic options? Can you shine a little light on that?
Yeah, so many benefits, because there, people don't drink today for all sorts of reasons, not because they're just sober. We'll take breaks from drinking. People don't drink for health reasons. People don't drink because they just don't feel like it in that moment. People are doing less, and people are sober. To me, it's like real inclusivity is offering options for everyone. So just like when you go and you look at my menu, there are plant-based options. There are gluten-free options. There are nut. I mean, I take all of that into consideration when I write a menu. Because I think it's important, because look, it's not a fad, it's not a trend. people are changing how they treat themselves. And for me, if I, from experience, when I go into a restaurant and I don't have an option of something to drink, that leaves me with what options? Water, soda, maybe over the, you know, over the past 10 years or so, like sparkling waters, right? There's all sorts of seltzers and sparkling waters now, which is great. I love those. But as a business owner, like, well, back to like as a guest perspective. So I'm in that situation. If I don't want something like that, then what do? So I have to like stop, say I'm with a party of six people. Maybe I don't know all of them well. Then I have to stop everyone and be like, okay, what do you have for me? That's not how I am. I'm not going to like stop everyone doing their things and be like, what do you have for me? And then at that point, then I have to put, you know, is it a bartender? Is it someone waiting on our table? I have to get put them through this like, well, we can go talk to the bartender. Maybe he can make you something. Do you like sweet? Do you like fresh? Do you like spicy? Right? You get this whole thing. And then they go to the bar.
The whole rigmarole. The whole, right? Yeah.
And then as a restaurant operator or professional, I like look at the bar. Then I watch the chef like, or not the chef, the bartender, like, so like the server's talking to the bartender. And then I'm like, put out my party. I've put out the server. I've put out the bartender. It's like this whole fuss. And then what I get something that's not good. There's no thought into it. It's some sweet and sour and some sparkling water and some orange juice or something, right? And then I get this like crappy cocktail and they don't know how to charge me. And I get an open food charge for $8 for something I don't want. And it's just, it's not a good experience. So like from a hospitality and an operator perspective, like why wouldn't I try to evolve that experience to something that is enjoyable and might even bring people back in your door?
And I can tell you, 100%.
So many people come back in our doors because of our non-alcoholic options. And it's amazing. Yep. So if I take the, if I can find beverage professionals who love to make cocktails, whether or not they have alcohol in them, that's great. It's often like the our bar staff looks at it as something like creative, something fun. Mm. Then we create these cocktails. And then I also like another thing, your margin on a bottle of Topo Chico is what's popular here, right? So what was for a long time. There's a bunch more now. But, you know, if I make 75 cents on a bottle of Topo Chico, maybe I have a really great margin and I'm selling it for too much and I make $1.50 on a bottle of Topo Chico. If I sell a cocktail, a craft cocktail that I've put a lot of effort into creating, I can make a much better margin on that and probably sell multiple of them because they're delicious and they're unique. And I'm and so that's for like a business operator standpoint. But for someone who wants to create true hospitality, like I know that the guest isn't going to have to like be fussed over or brought attention to them. Maybe I don't want anyone to know I'm not drinking, right?
Right.
Or I don't want to make a big deal out of it. So like our cocktails are in the cocktail menu, so I can just order something with no ABV. And it's great. So it's like it checks a lot of boxes.
Yeah, and easier on the staff. Like
yeah,
because it's like. Yeah, it's on the menu. It's easy. Like, just do it. Like, exactly. Fire it off.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, so easier all around.
Our company owns a bar that some of my business partners started almost 10 years ago. They're about to hit their 10, or they just hit their 10-year anniversary. And for years, they've had an unleaded section on the bar.
Oh, it's love that.
It's a garage, and it's like a car, vintage car theme to it. And they've had this unleaded section of the bar for as long as I've been part of the company for like 7 years. But I think it's been there for 8 or 9 years. And that is to me, the first bar I ever saw with a fully dedicated non-alcoholic cocktail menu, with its own name and its own everything. And now, that still exists and it's still super successful, but now we have all these products, in the non-alcoholic space, where you can have, whether they're like ready to drink, commercially packaged goods, like with nootropics and adaptogenics and all of that, which I don't really get personally, but it's cool. And then you have, you know, the Seed Lip and Tennyson and Slow Luck. And those are some of the ones around here that are really popular. And so you have non-alcoholic spirit replacements where you can make cocktails. And then you have whole catalogs of non-alcoholic wines, non-alcoholic beers. Whereas before you had what, O'Doul's? And then mm-hmm. after O'Doul's, there was like Heineken Zero came out. There's a couple other ones. Still not for me, but there's some amazing ones now. Hop waters, things like that. So
yeah.
Now from an operator perspective, you can, there's just a whole catalog of non-alcoholic options that you can put behind your bar, you can put on your menu, you can put in a cooler, and it's become a very much, much easier. So if you're not doing it, you're missing an opportunity to not only sell something at possibly a better margin and a higher PPA or a higher check average, but you're, most importantly, you're missing the opportunity to like really include anyone who walks through your door who may be going through something with alcohol that you don't even need to know anything about. You just need to have some options.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally. I love that menu name, Unleaded. Like, that's so great. That's so cute. I want to check that out.
Yeah, Garage is a very cool bar.
I love that. Well, Philip, thank you so much for your experience, sharing your wisdom and your knowledge with us. Where can we follow you and find you on the World Wide Web?
Sure. I am on Instagram, mostly of the social media. I do have a TikTok and Twitter account, but I'm not active on them. Instagram at Philip Spear, my run club at Comedor Run Club, all one word. Comedor Run Club. And then the restaurant is at Comedor TX. That's where you can find me on the web. I have a website, chefphilipspear.com, and I have some cool products that I sell on that website too, if you're interested in that. And that's it.
Great. And just to clarify, for the Run Club, I just wanted to clarify, for the Run Club, can anyone who's in the, like, restaurant industry join the Run Club, or what, how does that look like?
Yeah, anyone who's in the hospitality business, but really anybody. We have a lot of crossover. We have other fitness and wellness people who come and run with us. You mentioned Lululemon earlier as Lululemon ambassador for years, and we were able to bring all sorts of people who love running and fitness to come run with us. It's really just about making connections. But at the base, we are a hospitality group, and anybody is welcome. The idea is that we are creating a space for people to either create or maintain healthy habits around the restaurant business. So we have a 1, 2, and 3 mile route. So even if you're not an avid runner, or running is something that you want to get into, or maybe for previously run and now you want to get back into it, by having these separate routes and people who can like kind of help you with those routes, we hope to make it so that it's comfortable for everyone to come and join. I know it can be intimidating. I know it probably looks a little bit intimidating on social media. I know that we sometimes put out in the world that some of us have completed marathons or ultra marathons. And that's true. However, that time is about community. It's a social run. It's building rapport with the community and with each other. And that's what that time is about. All of those other things happen on like outside time, training runs, maybe if for some of us at 5 a.m, but that 10 a.m. Monday, Wednesday, Friday is a social community connection run. And it's not about speed or pace or strength or experience. It's just about being there.
Love that. Well, I'm definitely going to start off with the 1 mile run.
Perfect. Yeah, please. And then we do yoga immediately after the run.
In the building. Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, I will definitely do some yoga. That sounds great. I absolutely love what Philip is doing for the community. It's time to flip the script. Let's change the narrative and what certain industries look like or what they're known for. One last note before you go, it's important to remember that everyone's experience changing their relationship with alcohol is different. However, one thing that remains consistent is the need for support. Head to SoberGirlsGuide.com. We have tips and tricks at any stage of your booze-free journey. We got your back. With live coaching calls, homework and exercises to implement ASAP into your daily routine, our Sober Girls Guide group coaching will give you the accountability, structure, community, and support to change your relationship with alcohol and never look back. Just think, today could be the day you stop doing that self-destructive thing you do. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.